This is WNHN LP 94.7 in Concord, streaming at WNHNFM.org. You are listening to State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. And even though the legislature, the House and Senate, have been relatively inactive, there actually is a lot to report on.
I want to actually start, Maggie, by giving a shout out to Nancy West, InDepthNH.org. For news, but also Nancy has been posting information about these different task forces which have been established by the governor and by the Secretary of State. There are also phone numbers that members of the public can use to call in and be able to listen to what's going on. So check out indepthnh.org.
And Nancy West is sincerely trying to bring the people news about the state's response to this crisis. She has some very important questions.
Yeah, I mean, one of the controversies, Maggie, has to do with the state contract with a company that's called ConvenientMD, which has been providing testing for people who are allowed to get tested in the state. But the company happens to be co-founded by some people who are donors to the governor's political campaign. So it's a legitimate question that people are asking, how did that contract get made? Who has seen the details? And this is becoming very difficult to find out. Normally, the contracts are approved by the executive council, which sees them ahead of time, but not so in these cases, the way I understand it. And normally, money that comes into the state outside of the regular budget process gets approved by the legislative fiscal committee, which is meeting on a regular basis, but the governor is insisting that he has the authority to spend the money and doesn't need them to weigh in at all. And that is the subject of a lawsuit. The governor has a deadline of today to respond to the latest motion for reconsideration filed by Democratic members of the fiscal committee. So we are continuing to keep an eye on that fundamental constitutional question, even in times of emergency, who is it who gets to decide how the state conducts its business? And how does the public have an opportunity to keep an eye on it in order for us to exercise our rights and our authority as citizens?
And it's truly a situation where the decisions themselves matter as much as the process by which these decisions are made. And so we're grateful for people paying close attention to this.
Now, Maggie, you had a chance to discuss some of this with State Senator Dan Feltes early this morning.
Yes, and folks will hear Senator Feltes talking about the urgent need for more testing and for greater protections for residents and staff in long-term care facilities. And then somewhat of a timeline for the Senate to continue its work on legislation as well.
Now, today is the day in which retail stores, golf courses, hair salons and barbershops, and drive-in movie theaters are allowed to reopen under the stay-at-home 2.0 orders released by Governor Sununu just a little bit over a week ago. So again,
and Arnie, say a little bit about what are the kinds of restrictions that, say, retail stores, it may vary based on the type of retail that it is, but what kind of restrictions are they having to agree to in order to reopen?
Well, I believe they're trying to reduce the density of the number of people who can go in by about half. They're saying that all of the employees need to wear masks. They're certainly encouraging customers to wear masks, and I believe many of the stores will be passing out masks to customers. These are all specified in a set of what are called guidelines. You can find this information if you go to nh.gov and click on the stay-at-home 2.0 section there. You can find these different sets of guidelines for each of these different sectors of the economy, for retail stores, for restaurants, for drive-in movies, for golf courses. One of our questions, Maggie, in fact, a letter that I sent this morning to the governor's reopening task force is, are these really enforceable mandates or are these just suggestions? Because they use words like requirement, they use words like must, but the governor has also said that he's not creating a police force to go out and enforce these guidelines. So are they suggestions or are these actual rules that carry some kind of weight? And what happens to workers who believe that these rules are not being enforced? These are questions that I've still got, and I think that you do as well.
Yes, and we've been saying that a lot more needs to be done in terms of public service announcements or some manner of public education with regard to worker safety, with regard to protections for not losing your unemployment benefits if you either don't have the childcare or you don't feel safe to return to work or your employer is not creating a safe working environment. I mean, reassurances that there won't be negative consequences are not sufficient for people to be making the kinds of decisions that affect the economic well-being and their own safety and the safety of everyone in their household.
Now, we'll be talking later on in this show in an interview with Joanne Asheim, who is the executive director of New Hampshire Public Health Association, which has been convening weekly meetings to talk about these issues with from across the state. Finally, Maggie, one of the places where people are most vulnerable, of course, is inside of our jails and prisons. Can you provide a quick update on the ACLU lawsuit regarding immigrants detained at Stafford County?
So last week was a week of bail hearings with Chief Judge Landia McCafferty in the U.S. District Court. Including one that happened this morning, there have been 8 bail hearings. 6 people have been approved for release. So that is obviously very good news. People are being released to house arrest with an option for electronic monitoring. So it's a situation where there will still be a certain degree of confinement, but in much safer, much more humane conditions than they were living in at the Stafford County Jail. So multiple networks of faith groups and others have organized to provide supports as needed for people who need quarantine housing, who need host homes, etc. But we're continuing to see favorable outcomes from the U.S. District Court.
And we're continuing to see never again demonstrations outside the jail on weekends. Maggie, how did you spend your weekend?
Well, I was treated very well as a mother and was delighted to listen in on the Joyce Anderson Mother's Day Eve concert called Songs for Peace, which we were delighted and grateful that that concert was a benefit for the Arnie Alpert Action Fund. So I, like many others, watched a YouTube live stream, and it was really beautiful.
Great. We'll have a little bit of the music from that show later on in this episode of State House Watch here on WNHNLP. And Maggie, did you get anything done around the house on Saturday?
Yes, I have started to tackle a job that has been on my to-do list for some time. I spent a few hours painting the living room.
Holes in the ozone the size of Brazil. Barges of trash in the chewable breeze. Pools of industrial wasteland pate. Sulfur dioxide dissolving the trees. Pretty soon it will all end with a boom. Why am I painting the living room?
I have the whole day off, 'cause it's a Saturday. There is a blue grass band somewhere along the bay. Look at the lilacs bloom. Why am I painting the living room?
A pinhead evangelist pays for his sin with a $5 fine for a black collar crime. Kingpins of industry knowingly nod. Just like Lake Erie, they're 12% slime. They wink at the president, do I assume? And here I am painting the living room.
I hear the bluebirds sing. Don't let the day go by. Look at the blossoms blow over the blue, blue sky. All with a wild perfume. And here I am painting the living room. Why am I painting the living room? 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 I have the whole day
on the size of Brazil.
'Cause it's a Saturday.
Trash in the
there is a blue
pools of industrial waste.
that the lilacs
will all
bloom
end with a boom.
Why am I painting the living room? I hear a
pinhead evangelist sing for his sin.
Don't let the
$5 fine
go
for a black collared crime.
Look at the blinds over the blue,
just like Lake Erie, they're 12%
slow.
They wink at the president's tune, I assume.
And here I am painting the living room.
Ah, yes, I can see how my tombstone will read. Here lies someone of exceptional worth. Though she did not do a lot for her kind or help hold together this crumbling earth, here lies a woman they're saying of whom sure had a good-looking living room.
Why am I painting the living room?
Why am I painting the living room?
You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN LP 94.7 FM, streaming at WNHNFM.org. That was Lou and Peter Berryman with the age-old question, why am I painting the living room?
You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee, and I am in our Zoom studio this week with State Senator Dan Feltes, our Senate Majority Leader. From his home or office in Concord, where are you today, Dan?
Our spare bedroom in my home in the south end of Concord with Aaron and our two girls, Iris and Josie.
Very good. Well, I hope you're well and that you're all navigating this, feeling connected to each other and safe.
Yes, you too, Maggie. It's great to see you as always.
So we have a lot to touch on and we don't have a lot of time, but I'd love to jump right in. Well, maybe first we'll start with just the question of process. So the state Senate has not convened since some point in mid-March, is that right?
Neither the Senate or the House have convened since mid-March. There's two ways that the legislature really takes action. One is to the Joint Legislative Fiscal Committee, which is supposed to approve expenditures, budgetary items, and have oversight over budget related matters. So that has been meeting. The other way that the legislature takes action, obviously, is passing bills. And so I anticipate that kind of activity to happen again in June. In terms of the Joint Legislative Fiscal Committee, you may have seen that the Governor Sununu refuses to acknowledge its authority. So what resulted was a lawsuit. Governor Sununu has refused to acknowledge the Joint Legislative Fiscal Committee's authority. He's refused to acknowledge the Executive Council's authority. I don't know if the Executive Council is contemplating a lawsuit too, but the legislature has gone to court over Sununu refusing to go to oversight of expenditure of funds. And Maggie, this is an unbroken practice of Democratic and Republican governors alike, including Craig Benson, including John Lynch, during times of an emergency. They have gone to the fiscal committee for approval for expenditures. It's not that complicated. And to just ignore the fiscal committee, to ignore the legislature, refuse to work with people is what Governor Sununu is doing, and including having, quote, total authority over $1.25 billion in federal stimulus dollars that are coming into the state. That's just not the New Hampshire way. And what this case is about and what everything's about is making sure the money gets out the door quickly to the people that need it. The bailouts of the past need to be a thing of the past. We need to look out for working people, working families, people left out and left behind, businesses on Main Street, not Wall Street. We got to look out for ordinary people. And Maggie, you know, I was a legal aid lawyer during the last crisis, the Great Recession. I had the honor and privilege of serving in that capacity at New Hampshire Legal Assistance. I help people during and after, including facing foreclosures all across New Hampshire, fighting back against that from Wall Street banks, facing an unemployment insurance system that was broken then. It's even more broke now, and thousands of people are without unemployment insurance checks because Governor Sununu won't update the computer system and make it a priority. Vulnerable people falling through the cracks, and we're seeing that again in long-term care and nursing home facilities when Governor Sununu did not heed the calls. Let's be blunt about it. Did not heed the calls to do widespread testing and routine testing of all workers, all residents. That's a CDC guideline. He didn't do it. It hasn't, as a result, he didn't prevent outbreaks and he hasn't mitigated outbreaks. And New Hampshire has made national headlines, unfortunately, based on these terrible outbreaks in our facilities. It's heartbreaking. I represented people in long-term care. I mean, these are some of our most vulnerable. You know, you've got people in long-term care, the residents who are seeing their friends get lost and perish to this. And you got family members of residents who can do nothing. They're on the outside who are just praying every day that their loved ones will be okay. And to say, as Governor Sununu does, anytime someone raises concerns, oh, they're just playing politics. That's his tagline. That silences people because people have a fear of speaking out for fear of being cast as quote unquote playing politics in a pandemic. That's not appropriate. And he said the same thing on the nursing homes and long-term care facilities. So we got to move forward. Can't wait till the next election, Maggie. These people need to be helped right now.
So let's talk about what, there's a lot in what you just said. What do you believe should be the priorities of the $1.25 billion that's arriving from the federal government?
Well, certainly we got to stabilize our healthcare system, including long-term care. We have to use the money in a way that will help with testing, widespread testing, helping workers. We have another $17 million that was brought into the state for testing. But, you know, we put forward a workers' bill of rights last week. Any worker that's going to reengage in the economy should have access and a right to have access to testing. And workers in healthcare settings in particular should have a right to not just access testing, but access routine testing. So we need to get a handle on the healthcare situation in the state. Our hospitals need help. Governor Sununu made a hospital fund. He only dispersed about $20 million of it. It did not stop job losses at our hospitals. Over 1,000 hospital workers were laid off. We come to find out that one of the major grants coming out of that, $1.6 million of the only $20 million he spent, went to a private for-profit company that happens to be a major campaign contributor of Governor Sununu. So this is not the way to deal with these monies. These monies need to help our healthcare system, save jobs, stabilize our healthcare system, and then we need a pathway for relief and recovery that looks out for ordinary people, not just those at the top. That we do affordable housing. We do capitalize that affordable housing fund. We do homelessness support. We support families, we support the unemployment insurance system, and we support good jobs of tomorrow so people can get back up on their feet. That's what this should be all about. That's what that money should be used for. And
are you saying the process for those decisions needs to be the Joint Fiscal Committee in conversation with the governor and the executive council? I mean, what's the process that's truest to our established mechanism?
The process that's truest to the law is that the governor needs to put forth a plan and with advice and consent of the fiscal committee. The individual contracts then need to be approved by the executive council, but the general buckets need, the law is very clear. It says advice and consent of the fiscal committee. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, I can tell you that when we get back in session, we're going to pass bills that direct some of that money in a way that works for working people and ordinary folks. We'll see what he does with those bills, but we got to make this work for ordinary people. I saw it, you saw it, Maggie, during the last recession, the last economic crisis. That people were left out. We can't let that happen again. I mean, this is exposing so many systemic problems.
Absolutely.
That we knew were there. Mm-hmm. and pushed our healthcare system to the very edge. It's pushed so many families to the very edge. And if you're going to do a reopening, which Governor Sununu has already started, by the way, mm-hmm. and you're going to do it, you need to make childcare a major part of that.
Absolutely.
Right now, about only 5,000 Grand State kids are in child care when in February there's 46,000. You know what that means? It means that a lot of working parents are being called back to work right now, saying, come back to work. Here's your job. Mm-hmm. And they don't have access to child care right now. So they're literally choosing between their job and their kids. Mm-hmm. And then what happens if they turn down that job? Do they lose out on unemployment insurance? In some cases, they are. It doesn't make any sense. It's not fair. It's not right for kids. It's not right for our families. And it's not the way to reopen. By the way, I mean, there's a big question about whether or not you should reopen right now anyways. That being said, we need to look out for workers and families if you're going to undertake this. And we need to look out for workers and families as how we spend the stimulus monies. I mean, this has
What do you recommend a worker do if he or she is pressured to return to work and their employer is not offering sufficient protective equipment or utilizing protocols for worker safety?
Well, you ought to, if that's the case, and this isn't legal advice, but if that's the case, workers should be eligible for ongoing unemployment insurance. It's not altogether clear that that's the case right now. And workers should have a right to testing, and there should be routine and ongoing testing in job sites of 10 or more people. And in healthcare settings, including substance use disorder treatment centers, including long-term care and nursing home, including hospitals, those workers should have access to ongoing and routine testing. And
how are we doing on testing right now?
We put forward a plan to test. We're 30th in the nation in New Hampshire and last in New England. Residents and workers of long-term care facilities were not tested widespread and ongoing basis. Just last week, we heard an announcement that the Sununu administration is shooting to test all residents, finally. And let's be clear, this wasn't something that was coming out of nowhere. Everybody knew that this would be a problem in long-term care and nursing home facilities. And everybody knew, and there were CDC guidelines about how to deal with this. Mm-hmm. You need PPE in a widespread scale for all the workers. Mm-hmm. You need routine and ongoing testing of all workers and all residents. That never happened under Chris Sununu. He never made it a priority. The first significant step he took, Maggie, was on April 15th when he announced a contract to test some of the workers in Rockingham and Hillsborough County and long-term care facilities. That was a no-bid, clearly insufficient contract with a major campaign contributor. This is what's happening right now. So we need to, and look, like I said, this can't wait for the next election. Mm-hmm. This can't wait for people to feel more comfortable about raising potentially controversial issues in a pandemic. We have to raise these issues right now. That's incumbent upon all of us to look out for people, especially our most vulnerable.
Can you talk a little bit about how the Senate will wrap up its legislative business for this year? What I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what do you anticipate will be the process to complete the work that was started in January?
So the Senate and the House are working in unison, and we'll work in unison, and we'll work on. Obviously, we're going to have some sessions, and how many yet to be clear, but we're going to have sessions in June. There's going to have to be proper safeguards in those sessions. There's going to have to be proper safeguards if there's public hearings on different pieces of legislation. We need to look out for public safety and public health.
Do you think public hearings could happen electronically? For example, the House Finance Committee had a committee meeting last week. Could that be the forum for public hearings, or does it need to happen in a physical space?
I think people are still working through that. The public hearings are different than an exec session, which mm-hmm. there's been plenty of those, but I think those are different. People are still working through that. But in terms of wrapping it up, there'll be plenty of activity in June on that. There's activity now that's gonna go into June on legislation. And the Joint Legislative Fiscal Committee, like I said, continues to meet to try to take actions, which it's by law is supposed to take action on, and Governor Sununu is ignoring it.
Is it likely that the House and Senate would need to meet through July, August, into the fall as well?
I don't think so, but we'll continue to look at it. But I mean, there's nothing set in stone right now, but certainly there's gonna be a lot of activity in June. There's a lot of activity right now leading up to June. But the upshot right now is on the issues, the problems that people care about, the problems that we're seeing right now on the ground, particularly in long-term care and nursing homes, all of us need to speak out, because that's not a function of the legislature, quite frankly, at all. I mean, the administration needs to make it a priority. And the only way we get them to make it a priority is if we continue to speak out and, mm-hmm. and continue to raise our voices about how we need to treat these problems in long-term care and nursing home facilities the way they should be treated. And it's really heartbreaking. I mean, and so I would just encourage all of us to start speaking out about that right now.
And how would you recommend people speak out? That they call the governor's office, that they email the gopher, that they let their own elected officials at the state level know?
In terms of that specific issue, that's going to be simply public pressure. So literacy editor, Facebook posts, calling the governor's office, that sort of thing. If you have specific ideas related to how the stimulus money should work for folks, you can reach out to Gopher, you can reach out to your legislature. But the reality is that Governor Sununu has claimed complete control over it anyway. So mm-hmm, I mean, mm-hmm. the most important thing you can do is raise your voice publicly about what you think is a major priority. So, and then, you know, whatever money is left over, we'll pass bills on it and he may veto it anyways. So look, I think now is a time where being active and engaged and having your voice heard is critical. I mean, I'm reminded of the quote from Bobby Kennedy and then apartheid South Africa quote, I know you know, and I hold dear. It's from Bobby Kennedy when he was down there in Cape Town, and he said, each time someone stands up for an ideal, or strikes out against injustice, or acts to improve the lot of others, they send forth a tiny ripple of hope. And through many acts of kindness, those ripples turn into waves, and those waves can shake down the greatest walls of intolerance and injustice that still exist. Mm. That quote on activism, Maggie, it was true then, it's true now. It's true especially now. It doesn't go away because we're in a pandemic. Democracy doesn't die in a pandemic. If anything, now is the time to be more active and more engaged. So I just encourage all your listeners and viewers to speak out, have your voice heard on the issues that matter to you, your family, our communities. Now is the time for you to step up and stand out and speak out. And don't be afraid. Do not be afraid that someone might say, well, you know what? You just quote playing politics in a pandemic. That's not the case. Do not be silenced by that kind of politics. Speak out. This is your democracy. This is your future.
Our community.
Please speak out right now.
Well, Senator Dan Feltes, thank you very much for spending time with me. I know your time is short and you have a busy day ahead of you. So I really appreciate you making the time.
Thank you very much, Maggie, for all that you do. And to all your listeners, thank you for all your activism.
That was Senator Dan Feltes with Maggie Fogarty. This is Joyce Anderson with Harvey Reed from her Mother's Day Eve Songs for Peace concert. For more information about Joyce and her music, visit joyscream.com. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN-LP.
I wrote this song on the eve of when we started bombing Iraq. And first time I sang it was with Mary Westfall and my mother at a vigil that Mary had at the Durham Community Church. Kind of want to send it out to George W. Bush. Sending people to war for dubious reasons and then finding out the reasons were even more dubious than they thought and doubling down on your efforts.
Filled with love.
do not know my neighbor's name. My heart is filled with love. I love that stranger just the same. My heart is filled with love. Hope is rising from this place. My heart is filled with love. Divine wisdom, amazing grace. Harvey and I are streaming every Friday night at 8 p.m. So just show up at 8 and on my YouTube channel and listen anytime you want. I mean, there's shows galore. We've been doing it since April 10th. Thank you.
You are listening to State House Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert, and I am joined in our Zoom studio by Joanne Aschheim from the New Hampshire Public Health Association. Welcome to State House Watch, Joanne.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is your first time as a guest on our show, so I wonder if you could briefly say a little bit about yourself and the work of the New Hampshire Public Health Association.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I've been the executive director at the New Hampshire Public Health Association for 3 years now. Prior to that, I spent most of my professional life in state government, in public health, in New Hampshire, at the Division of Public Health Services, with a short stint at the Connecticut Department of Public Health. So I'm a long life public health advocate and manager with areas of expertise in maternal and child health, performance improvement, and public health in general.
Well, great. And say a little bit about the New Hampshire Public Health Association. Is it primarily a professional group? Is it an advocacy group? Is it an educational group? What does it do? And what are your priorities in normal times?
The New Hampshire Public Health Association was established in 1992, initially established as an advocacy organization because of the fact that state, local, municipal organizations can't always advocate for public health issues. So the founders decided that there was really a need in the state to have an organization that could advocate for public health issues. So we are a membership organization. We serve at the pleasure of our members. We champion public health policy. So we have three essentially strategic priorities. Serving as a collective voice for public health policy and advocacy, workforce development for the professionals who are members and others in the field, and public health messaging. So getting the word out about what are some key public health messages and priorities.
Well, I think I can speak for many people to say that we, most of us, normally don't think a whole lot about public health, and people like you are thinking about it all the time. But when the news of this pandemic started to break and we realized we were in for something extremely serious, things changed for the association as well. So could you say a little bit about what the Public Health Association has been doing over the last couple of months to do that, getting out the message that you think is important about public health right now in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so ironically, this whole COVID pandemic coincided with National Public Health Week, where we try to raise awareness of what public health is doing every day. And this year, we had to take a little bit of a different spin and talk about just what important contributions our public health colleagues are making in the assessment and mitigation of this pandemic, and working extremely hard to do that. And so public health does come into the eye of the public when there is a pandemic like this. When things are running smoothly and public health is doing their job, we suffer from invisibility. But clearly we're very visible right now.
Hopefully we're all learning about hand hygiene and wearing of masks and social distancing. But what are the key things that you want members of the public, and for that matter, the governor, his advisors, members of the legislature, and others, what do you want them to be thinking about right now?
Well, so I heard an interesting quote this morning that talked about that this whole COVID-19 pandemic is like putting gasoline on the fires of health disparities in this country. And I think that's really a fitting description of what we're seeing. The things that we are addressing, that we're trying to address with the task force that we've been working with, is really to look at the disparities of populations, of marginalized populations in this state that are coming to light and being amplified by the pandemic. Things like lack of access to health care, health information not being translated into foreign languages or into at literacy levels that people can understand, people not getting screened adequately. Some of the economic implications of the pandemic, again, only amplify some of the things that were already in existence: food insecurity, housing insecurity, homelessness. It's just being exacerbated at this time. And so the things that we're focusing on now, in addition to obviously the very critical tasks of treating patients and screening, but the economic effects and the health effects have long-term ramifications that are being highlighted now. And it's our hope that if we pay attention to some of those things as they're highlighted now, they can improve the health of the public going forward.
Great. Joanne Asham, I understand that recently the Public Health Association and the task force that you've mentioned have sent a letter to the governor with a number of very specific things that you would like to see the governor incorporating into his stay-at-home plans for the coming weeks and months. Could you just mention what are a couple of the most important elements of that?
Right. So I just wanted to say a little bit about the task force that I referenced. So the task force we're calling the COVID Equity Task Force, and we've been convening it for about 5 weeks now. It's made up of individuals and organizations that represent marginalized populations. So the most vulnerable communities of color, low-income individuals, people with disabilities, and others. So the group has been working. We've been co-convening this group with the Department of Health and Human Services. And we've broken into several groups, areas of interest and priority areas. So we've issued two letters to date to the governor's office and the reopening task force. One is about protection of workers now and as we reopen. And it looks at things such as implementing a hotline so that employees could anonymously report if they feel unsafe at work without retribution, looking at hazard pay, designating grocery stores and grocery store workers as essential workers for protection purposes, making sure that they can receive antibody testing, that people are wearing facial coverings when they're shopping, etc. So there's a long list of recommendations that's been submitted to the governor.
I noticed one of the things that surprised me is it said restrict facial coverings with exhaust valves. I had not even heard of that. What is a facial covering with an exhaust valve?
I think that they're referring to N95 masks there. And I believe that what they're saying is we need to assure that those masks are being used in healthcare settings and that we are using cloth masks in retail and other establishments.
Do you have the impression right now that people who are working in healthcare settings, in hospitals, and in nursing homes are getting access to the personal protective equipment that they need? Or is that a deficiency in the state of New Hampshire right now?
I can't honestly say where we are with that. I know we've had a great influx of personal protective equipment coming into the state. I don't think it's probably uniform whether people have the supplies that they need. So I don't feel that I can respond to that. I think the Division of Public Health Services could respond to that more adequately.
Good. Well, I hope they're paying attention to that. And as you notice, the groups that are most vulnerable, that we know that a lot of the people who work in healthcare settings are perhaps more likely to be women, more likely to be immigrants and refugees, more likely to be people of color, and maybe people, especially in the lower income parts of the healthcare sector, are likely to be people who were already perhaps more vulnerable to some of the economic and health ramifications that you've described. Joanne, you also mentioned a second letter, which I believe focuses on correctional settings. What should governor or the state be doing that they're not doing right now with regard to people who are either housed in prisons and jails or people who are working in those facilities?
Right. So we want to make sure both of those groups are protected. And some of the recommendations that came out of the letter from our subcommittee working on incarcerated individuals in that group includes ensuring that there's social distancing. And one of the ways that that can be achieved is by commuting sentences, expediting probation and parole proceedings, releasing immigrant detainees, and of course, always with a mind that keeping the public safe. So we're not talking about releasing violent offenders, but those who are there for other offenses. Removing vulnerable individuals from correctional facilities. So the elderly, people with multiple health disorders, pregnant women, and making sure that in these facilities that they're screening, and then that there are opportunities for proper hygiene and sanitation.
Well, we noticed that in recent days, the governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery has created a webpage, and there's a contact portal there So if people want to be able to send messages to the folks who are responsible for managing the state's response, you can certainly go there and send a message, or go to the governor's website and send a message to him directly to reinforce the messages coming from the New Hampshire Public Health Association about the importance of the state stepping up to protect the people who are most vulnerable. I have to say, Joanne, that I've noticed that all of these advisory committees that the governor has been creating and that the Secretary of State have been creating to figure out how the state is going to adjust and adapt, certainly in general, have a lot of well-intentioned and experienced people on them, but generally leave out people who can speak for those folks who are most vulnerable, workers in hazardous settings, people of color, people living in congregate housing situations. So clearly there is some work to do. Now, I know that your interest especially goes to issues of food insecurity. And I noticed that a couple days ago, there was a national report that said that perhaps 1/5 of all children in the country are food insecure right now. So I wonder, Joanne, if you could say a little bit about how you assess the situation here in New Hampshire and what is being done to address food insecurity.
Yeah, so prior to the pandemic, New Hampshire does a little bit better than some of the rest of the country, and about 12% of children in New Hampshire are considered to be food insecure. I don't know what that number is now. I don't know if we know that. But we do have a subgroup in this task force looking at food insecurity, and we've been trying to wrap our head around what the gaps and the needs are. And initially, we had heard that there was some concern about some of these marginalized populations, refugees, immigrants, low-income populations, not being able to access public programs, and also potentially not having transportation to food pantries. We've been doing some research, and it seems as though there's been quite a lot done in this area. There are just numerous types of responses that are happening with drive-through food pantries, tremendous number of volunteers volunteering to deliver food to individuals, school buses that are out delivering food to families during the week and others on the weekends. So what we've heard so far is that Manchester and Nashua are doing a tremendous job addressing these issues, and that the North Country is. And we're still trying to gather information about some of the other parts of the state. So there's been a great influx of funding. Food pantries are just working on overdrive. And so we're really still trying to figure out, are these populations having challenges getting the food that they need? But we do know that this is a problem that's going to go on for some time because of the economic situation, and that people who have lost their jobs or their rent comes due after the 90 days are up are going to have to make some big decisions about food and housing. And so we need some long-term solution.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad that you and the Public Health Association and the task force are paying attention to those issues. We certainly need people like you who are savvy and smart and dedicated and can not only analyze the problem, but come up with ways to approach it. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about the work of the Public Health Association or how to find out more?
Yeah, so if people want to find out more, they can go to our website, nhpha.org. I do want to say that, you know, while we're focusing on COVID-19 now, we will be setting a legislative agenda for the next 1 to 3 years, and we will be focusing on vulnerable populations so that we can look at the long-term health and try and eliminate the disparities that we see in our population today.
Well, good. Well, hopefully we're all learning some valuable lessons that will continue when things get a little bit more normal, so that the normal we get back to is not one that's full of the kind of health disparities that you are so aware of. Joanne Asheim, thank you so much for being with us on State House Watch.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to State House Watch Radio with me, Maggie Fogarty, and my co-host Arnie Alpert on WNHNLP. Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all of our past shows, as well as Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and Sweet Caroline's Lounge Show. Join us again next week, and remember, there's a bright side somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. And there's more love somewhere. And there's more peace somewhere. I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. People got a good job somewhere. Got a lot of good friends somewhere. Got a little suitcase, got a little family.